I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be if by my heart I could fly.
Thank you for supporting local media in New York's Green and Columbia counties. You can make a contribution by calling 518-697-7400 or online at wgxc.org/donate. I'm Alexandra Cox, and I am one of the members of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. This morning, I'm going to be sharing some clips from the WBAI show On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. The report is a 60-minute news and talk program featuring analysis, commentary, policy recommendations, and action plans. It is broadcast from the perspective of people formerly incarcerated for stakeholders involved in criminal justice public policy formulation, law, research, legislation, reform litigation, social service provision, advocacy, and activism. The program's objective is to provide a forum for the discussion of criminal justice, political, community, economic development, and prison issues not regularly heard on traditional mainstream corporate media. It is designed to create a platform for the voices of those historically excluded from the discussion and decision-making process, yet who are most directly affected by the process. Today's show will also feature a couple of short news updates and some song requests from some of our listeners who are incarcerated. I wanted to start the show today with our first song request. This is Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley, requested by Cornell Harem at Eastern Correctional Facility.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
You would look for yours on earth, and now you see the light. sick and tired of your ism, schism, game, dine and go to heaven in the Jesus name, Lord. We know and we understand, Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light. What you gonna, we gonna do? Stand up for a right. Yeah. So you better get up.
That was Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley, requested by Cornell Herron. Just this month, the African American Policy Forum has released a report on the experiences of Black girls in the school system. This important report highlights the ways that Black girls experience the school-to-prison pipeline. I wanted to play a short clip from Democracy Now! That features Kimberly Crenshaw, professor of law at Columbia and UCLA and one of the authors of the report.
Professor Crenshaw, usually you're here in New York or you're in Los Angeles, but you're in Boston right now. Can you talk about the report that you just came out with and how this relates to 1 Billion Rising?
Well, we've been interested in some time in trying to address some of the specific obstacles that face girls of color. We've known for a while that there's something called the school-to-prison pipeline, but for the most part, when the pipeline is discussed, it's discussed primarily as something that affects boys. Recently, some numbers were released by the Department of Education that showed that, in fact, Black girls, 12% of Black girls were actually suspended from school, and that's a rate that is multiple times more than white girls. So we decided we wanted to find out what was happening in New York and in Boston with Black girls and what they told us. And we found some startling information. Black girls are 10 times more likely to be suspended than white girls in New York, 11 times more likely in Boston. But equally importantly, what the girls told us was that they're suspended for things that white girls would not be, and sometimes for things that Black boys would not be. So they're seen as defiant, they're seen as aggressive, they're seen as loud, rowdy, they say teachers see them as ghetto. So they're facing specific kinds of stereotypes in the school that causes them to be suspended. And they also have burdens that no one else has. They're the ones that take care of elderly people, they're the ones that take their parents to the immigration office to translate, they're the ones that look after little kids. So there are a lot of issues facing girls of color, Black girls in particular. And we want to rise with 1 Billion Rising to lift those issues up as well.
Up next, I interviewed Victoria Law about the report by Kimberly Crenshaw. Victoria Law is a journalist and activist who's written extensively about gender and the criminal justice system. I spoke briefly with Victoria about the report and her responses to it. She's written a little bit more about this report in a link that we shared with our newsletter readers.
So my name is Victoria Law. I am a freelance editor and writer, and I am a mom of one teenager in the New York City public school system. A lot of my writing and my activist and political work centers around intersections of gender, incarceration, and resistance. So a lot about women in prison, a lot about how prisons impact women, both in prison and in the community, and a lot about different ways that people resist and organize to challenge criminalization and mass incarceration. So that is what I write about.
And Victoria, could you, you know, this week we've just seen the release of a report. I shared a clip on this show with Kimberly Crenshaw talking a little bit about the impacts of the school system, but also the kind of criminal justice system more broadly on Black girls. And I was wondering, you know, even if you have not read the report, if you might be able to kind of comment a little bit about sort of how you, what you think about this contribution to kind of some of our thinking about the system.
Yeah. So I read the report when it first came out and I was like, oh, finally, you know, somebody's looking at not just how the school to prison pipeline affects young black men, which it certainly does, and I don't want to diminish that, but also how, what happens when you mash up gender and racism in the school systems that we have in New York and across the country. So one of the things that I found really striking is that black girls are more likely to be suspended than white girls, or 6 times more likely to be suspended than white girls, and black boys are 3 times more likely to be suspended than their white male counterparts. And I found that a really striking statistic that I was wondering why that hasn't grabbed people's attention more before when we're talking about ways in which race and education lead people either to prison or to college, or to other, you know, avenues in the future. So that's one of the things that really struck me is, you know, how we're not hearing these kinds of stories. We're centering, or until recently, we've been centering the experience of the school-to-prison pipeline and criminalization and policing in schools with the male experience, rather than saying, like, what happens when we add in gender? What happens when we then add in transgender people into this mix? Like, then how does this, how do these different identities intersect and perhaps further undermine people's ability to feel safe in school, people's ability to get an education, to not be policed, to not be pushed out either by the institution itself, via detentions and suspensions, expulsions, or because the school doesn't create a safe environment. There was a women or young black women talked about feeling unsafe and being sexually harassed and feeling vulnerable in schools. And that's one of the things that pushes people out. It's not something that schools necessarily like to record. They don't like to tout as, you know, our school is less safe than you would like to think. But it is one of the ways in which women are made to feel unsafe and pushed out of schools. And so if you think about ways in which school as an institution doesn't necessarily support people's safety and their right to education in the ways that they don't, in ways that they don't actually, you know, like promote atmospheres of, I don't want to say tolerance, because then it makes it kind of feel like, oh, you tolerate the fact that your neighbor makes a lot of noise, you know, but you really hate it. But, you know, like an understanding that people are diverse and we should embrace diversity and not fear it. And we should definitely not threaten people who are different. We should not shame them. We should not chase them out of school. We should not bully them. And we don't see that in so many schools. Even in schools that say that they, quote unquote, have respect for all, we don't necessarily see that. The report also talks about how girls have been criminalized, and even gone so far as, like, the school handcuffing them, calling the police, arresting them. I mean, there's a story of an 8-year-old with autism who threw a tantrum and was handcuffed. Like, why would you think that you should handcuff an 8-year-old under any circumstances? You know, you have adults, and supposedly adults who are supposedly trained in early childhood education, de-escalation conflicts, you know, like abilities to keep safety and security. Why would you then need to handcuff an 8-year-old? Are you saying that a group of adults cannot handle an 8-year-old who is throwing a tantrum? Another girl was threatened with criminal charges because she wrote "high" on a locker room wall. H-I, high. You know, 12-year-olds occasionally write things on the walls. You know, 25-year-olds write things on the walls. This is not necessarily a reason to threaten them with expulsion, you know, threaten them with criminal charges, and basically do something that will permanently affect their future.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really, what I appreciate about what you're saying is also recognizing that, you know, when you say sort of appreciating the diversity of experiences and modes of interaction that people bring to the table, is sort of that also, like, you know, that recognizing that people get identified as bad in very racialized and gendered ways. And
yeah,
and I think that's, yeah, that it, I see it, you know, in our listening area, there is a girls' juvenile facility for girls charged as adults. And although it's very small, you know, There are only 16 girls there right now. So many of these girls have been kicked out of their schools and their foster homes and many other placements before they got to this facility. And it's interesting to see the ways that they've been designated as bad in so many different institutions. Often, you know, for these expressions of themselves that are in many cases very minor sort of ways of speaking to their experiences. I think that's, it's really important what you're saying there. I think just briefly, it would be really interesting for you to hear, just to hear your perspective about why you think it's important for us, you know, as people who are thinking about incarceration, but also people inside who are thinking about ways of talking about incarceration while they're on the inside, especially in men's prisons. How do you think that, for example, men in men's prisons could begin to start talking a little bit more about the experiences of women inside and how it also may affect their experience?
Well, I think one of the ways, if you're inside a men's prison, to start talking about these experiences, A, talk about them, you know, and talk about them in a very real way about how does, you know, like what you did growing up or what you saw growing up, how would that have affected the young women around you? So if you were in a school where it was the norm to sexually harass girls, to make inappropriate comments about them, to rub up against them or shove them, or to undermine whatever they said, you know, think about the ways in which you might have participated or you might have silently condoned this kind of behavior. And then also think about the ways in which, you know, as you were growing up, this kind of behavior was condoned. One of, you know, some of the findings of the Black Girls Matter report is that schools often fail to intervene and stop sexual harassment and bullying of girls and then penalize them when they finally had enough and defended themselves. So, you know, if you think of it as a sort of like, you know, it's called a theater of the oppressed, you know, version of role playing. You think about an incident and you're like, okay, I was standing in the hallway and this person was harassing this girl and finally she had enough and she punched him in the nose and a school security officer came, saw this kid with bloody nose, immediately took this girl away. Now, if you kind of like could pause at any moment and say, what could you have done, you know, if you could press pause and intervene? You can't change anybody else's actions, but you can change your own. Maybe you could say, well, you know, maybe when this guy first started saying things about this girl, I could have stepped in and been like, hey, leave her alone. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, hey, do you want me to walk you to class and kind of shielded her from, you know, this kind of behavior? You know, or like, what could you have done in that moment? And then think about this as you kind of think about what you're doing with your life. And if you have children in your life, whether it be like sons, daughters, nieces, nephews, you know, grandkids, talk to them about these issues, because these issues don't exist in a bubble. People's elders either talk to them about not harassing girls, not, you know, not physically assaulting people or harassing people or, you know, undermining people, or they don't. And then people get their messages from the outside world that this is acceptable behavior because nobody in a position of authority or in a position of love and respect has ever said, hey, son, you know, we like women. We don't do this to them. You know, just tone it down. You know, like if you think some girl is pretty, you don't say it in this way. That is actually not the way that you want to express an appreciation for this person. So I think that, you know, just having these kinds of reflections and then having these kinds of conversations with the men around you who may not want to necessarily have these conversations at first, but hopefully everybody has a loved one in their life that they would not want to see bullied and harassed out of school, at risk for being assaulted, at risk for being criminalized because she felt that she had to defend herself. You know, so just ways in which they can talk about these issues and then figure out ways to impart this to other people in their lives, you know, whoever they have on the outside that is supporting them, you know, like whoever comes and visits them, whoever they're in touch with by letter or by phone. to say, hey, you know, like, so how are you doing in school? And if your daughter or granddaughter says, you know, like, every time I walk to school in the morning, you know, I have to walk through this row of guys catcalling me, you know, listen to that. And, you know, like, talk to her and talk her through some of this stuff. If you're, if you have a, you know, a child that identifies as a boy, you'd be like, so, you know, do you have a girlfriend? Do you have girls that you like? Something, something, you know, like, how do you relate to that person? And, you know, like, be like, hey, you know, we don't express appreciation in this way. We shouldn't be talking about girls in this manner. You know, this is not the way that we behave with other people.
I think that's a nice way to end, because it's sort of what you're talking about are both the kind of institutionalized responses and individual responses, and kind of how the two also intersect, in the sense that there are ways that people can kind of step in some ways where these institutions have been such failures to protect in some ways. Up next, we're going to hear a clip from WBAI's radio program On the Count, with many thanks to the staff at On the Count for letting us use their content today, especially to Khalil Cumberbatch.
Online this morning, we're going to be joined by Sister Piper Anderson. Piper Anderson has dedicated her life to using art, education, and collective action to generate creative strategies to end the criminalization of communities of color. In 2001, realizing the destructive impact of prisons and policing on her particular community, a 21-year-old Anderson became Blackout Arts Collective Lyrics on Lockdown National Tour Coordinator. Wow, and that is a mouthful. Blackout Arts Collective's Lyrics on Lockdown National Tour Coordinator. Piper is now founder and chief creative strategist at Create Forward, a consultancy that partners with communities to cultivate emergent strategies for social change. Piper also is a co-creator, along with Marlon Peterson, of Spread Mass Love in an Era of Mass Incarceration. And I know Piper was, I spoke to her when I was getting her on the line. She was waiting for someone to call from out of the country. I don't know if that person has connected with Piper yet, but anyway, Piper, how are you?
Hi, how you doing, Ron?
I'm good. We'd like to welcome you to On the Count.
Thanks for having me.
Were you able to connect with your friend?
With Marlon? No, he hasn't called in yet. He's in Trinidad right now, and so I don't know if he'll be able to join us. Hopefully he'll be able to get a connection.
Sure. Trinidad, huh? Lucky him.
Yeah.
I wish I was in Trinidad right now. Dodging some of this weather, huh?
Okay, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Spread Mass Love. What is that?
Yeah. So Spread Mass Love began as a dialogue between Marlon and I about 5 months ago. We have been talking for a while about co-authoring a piece of writing together. We're both writers. And I remember, I think, at one point, Marlon saying, you know, I really want to write about something that I haven't had a chance to write about, which is love. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. And as we started to write this piece, it became really clear that that our, you know, both being directly impacted by mass incarceration in different ways, we realized that it had, prisons had had a huge impact on the way we think about love and on our relationships to people closest to us. And so as we wrote the piece, you know, we realized that it was, that this had, you know, real impact for, you know, our communities. And we wanted to extend the dialogue beyond the essay that we wrote, which was published in January on SupportHarriet.com. We wanted to extend it beyond that to create a platform to share the stories of lots of other people who have been directly impacted. And so SpreadMassLove.com was born. We declared February Spread Mass Love Month. And throughout the month, we've been sharing the stories, courageous, powerful stories of people turning a critical lens on love and radically committing to relationship and to healing and to doing whatever it takes to sustain their, you know, their humanity and their relationships with the people closest to them.
Sure.
And so that's Spread Mass Love. And you know, and as it grows, it continues to evolve and will look like, you know, other things throughout the year. But right now it is this platform. And we invite people to go and to see the stories there, because there's some really, really powerful pieces up there on the site right now.
Most definitely. And before we let you go, we'll definitely get your contact information where folks can go and visit the website. Obviously, this particular project and others like it are very important, not only to you, but to a growing number of others. Why do you think these particular projects and your particular project, Spread Math Love, why do you think this is so important? Why do you think folks are gravitating towards spreading love through math,
yeah,
mass love?
Absolutely. You know, especially on a day like today, Valentine's Day, when we often think about love as this, you know, becomes this commercial holiday that's all about chocolates and red hearts. But what we're trying to do is really turn a real critical lens on how we think about love, you know, because again, as we were writing the piece, I started to think about the fact that, like, the state has always been, has enforced its role as this mediator in our relationships, has always dictated how and when we can love each other. Like, since slavery, since Black people arrived on these shores and chains, you know, the state has always dictated how we love. And then when you add to that, you know, 30 plus years of a war on drugs, and the reality of war, with it comes trauma and destruction and a legacy of immeasurable harm. And so you have generations, you know, like my generation, trying to recover and learn how to love and be loving after we spent most of our childhood watching our parents be ripped away or caring for them as they, you know, they deteriorate.
Sure.
And we put in work. We put in a lot of work to get here. Some of us made it. Some of us didn't. And so, you know, nobody really asks what the cost of that was. What is the cost of all of this destruction? And I think that, you know, I know the cost for me has been heavy, having parents who are formerly incarcerated and been impacted by the war on drugs. And my commitment is that, you know, that we take this moment to take a, you know, a critical look at love, because it's necessary for our healing, for ourselves and for each other.
Yes.
And as we welcome home, you know, those who are returning from doing time, it's really important that we think about, like, what is the state of our relationships and how do we repair the damage that's been done. And so that's really what Mass Love is about.
Wow. So, wow. All I can just say is wow. Definitely from someone who also is formerly incarcerated. You know, you don't hear guys, especially, you know, guys talking about love in the maximum security facility.
Mm.
And I guess, you know, it's definitely unfortunate because it is a so much of a part of who we are as people. And I think that love is what has held us together since we landed here. You know, kudos to you. And I tip my hat to, you know, what you're doing and the folks that you're working with. How can our listeners support what you're doing?
Yeah, so we're continuing to collect stories. We want to continue to, you know, provide lots of different perspectives. Continue to ask challenging questions. So, you know, we invite people to go to spreadmasslove.com and email us at spreadmasslove@gmail.com. And, you know, if you're interested in sharing your story, let us know. Also, you know, you can follow us on Twitter and spread, you know, continue to grow the platform and spread these stories around. The handle is spreadmasslove. And you can also come out to our first public event, which is going to be on Wednesday, February 25th at 7 p.m. at Columbia Law School. The address is 435 West 116th Street. And, you know, you like organizations like the Criminal Justice Caucus and the Center for Justice at Columbia University, the Center for the study of law there, study of law and culture, are sponsoring that event. And we think of the organizations that support us as agents of love. And so if you are part of an organization and you want to, you know, support this work through hosting a workshop or an event, become an agent of love and support us in that way. We're also going to be doing some workshops. You mentioned, you know, brothers in Maximum. Like, we're going to be doing some workshops in prisons on love, on writing, writing workshops on love. And so we're taking it inside. We're taking it into communities. And throughout the year, we'll be offering lots of ways in which people can continue to support and be a part of the dialogue.
Okay. Well, you just mentioned a whole bunch of stuff there. I was going to ask you to repeat your contact information.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that if you go to the website, you can find all of that there. So just, you know, go to spreadmasslove.com. And if you're, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. But everything you need to know about the project is on the website. So that's the place to go.
That is the place to go. Why should folks support WBAI?
You know, I have been listening to WBAI for a very long time, and have had the privilege of being on a number of different shows in WBAI. So I think of WBAI as a place where, one, I know work like this is supported. I know that, you know, when I need to find a space to be able to share really important work with a large audience, that WBAI is the place where, you know, where my voice can be heard. And so, so I'm thankful for that. And I think that's one reason why people should support, because it is the kind of platform that makes it possible for us to spread mass love. And I think also, you know, it creates, I mean, where else are you going to have a show like On the Count where you can talk about these kinds of issues, talk about mass incarceration and prisons and the criminal justice system and how it impacts us and hear our stories and our voices. So definitely people should support WBAI and make sure that, you know, that shows like this can continue.
My sister. We want to thank you, my sister, and tell Marlon that he missed out.
Yeah.
And when we have you back on again, we'd like to definitely do a follow-up with you.
Okay, that'd be great.
Especially after you said you're going to be visiting some prisons?
Yes.
Yeah, we'd definitely like to have you on and hear about that. And have you gone into prisons yet?
With this project, no. But having worked in prisons for the last like 13, 14 years, I have a lot of, you know, relationships with folks who are really excited about bringing this work in.
Sure.
And so it'll be great to come back and to be able to share some of those stories on the air.
Most definitely. We'd love to have you. Okay. So thank you and stay warm.
Thank you so much. You too.
All right, all right, and we'll definitely have you on again.
All right, sounds good.
All right, so that was Miss Piper Anderson. Definitely want to hear what's going on with Piper in the future about spread mass love. So
that was a clip from WBAI's
program On the Count, featuring Piper Anderson. WGXC's pledge drives are largely comprised of small donations of contributions of $10 through $50 from a wide range of supporters. We are listener-supported radio. Our funding comes from a broad spectrum of listeners with diverse interests and financial situations. Contributions are tax-deductible. Your contribution is tax-deductible to the fullest extent of the law, unlike most Indiegogo or Kickstarter campaigns. You can make a contribution by calling 518-697-7400 or online at wgxc.org donate. Our next song request came from Nelson Long Jr., and it's a song called Movin' by Brass Construction, a Brooklyn-based funk band from the 1960s. After this song, we'll be hearing again from WBAI's On the Count. We'll be right back.
before we get off the air, we have one more guest this morning. And we will bring Brother Darius Monroe. Darius Monroe is going to be with us in a second. Darius is a writer, director. He had no idea that his hobby of writing would supersede his dream of becoming an architect and lead him into the world of film. In 2004, Darius Monroe graduated with honors from the University of Houston with a BA in communications, media production. In the fall of 2004, Darius enrolled at New York University's Tisch School of Arts graduate film program. While at Tisch, Darius wrote, produced, directed the award-winning short films Testify, Midway, and Train. Darius also recently completed an autobiographical feature-length documentary entitled Evolution of a Criminal. Now that title is worth making a pledge. Evolution of a Criminal. And without further ado, Darius, welcome to On the Count.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate that kind intro. Thank you, brother.
I hope I did you as well as all the stuff that you've done, brother. It is a pleasure to have you on the count. And I'm sure that you have some interesting stuff that you would like to share with our listening audience. Can you tell us about the Evolution of a Criminal?
Sure, absolutely.
What motivated you?
So the film is an autobiographical feature-length documentary that I started on back in 2007, and took me about 7 years to complete. But the story is about how, when I was 16 years old, me and two others were involved in a bank robbery right outside of Houston, Texas, in a small town called Stafford. And the film explores just what systemic and familial and behavioral influences just pushes a 16-year-old to make the choice of, you know, robbing a bank, and then just the full scope of what happens after that decision is made. And, you know, like I said, this has been a personal project of mine, and it was while I was at NYU in my third year of film school where when I finally decided to make this film. This is after, you know, being in trouble, going to prison, and then getting out. But I just felt like this story needed to be told. There was just so much on my chest and so much that I felt like my family wanted to say, but that nobody had said, but needed to be, these words and these emotions and all of these feelings that were bubbling inside of us needed to come out.
Sure.
And the film just allowed us to go through this almost therapy. And yeah, that's what it's about.
I hear you, brother. And how long have you, how long did it take you to put the film together?
Yeah, so started in 07, and then we world premiered last year at the 2014 South by Southwest Film Festival down in Austin.
Sure, okay. And where can folks, is it available online, or?
Yeah, so it's, it just, it was available for free on it aired on PBS on January 12th, but it just took it offline. But it is available on iTunes, and then we also have educational DVDs available, and it'll also be on Netflix beginning March 20th.
Okay, great. And how did it lend to your personal experience of transformation?
I mean, for me, you know, the film is it sort of subverts. You know, I'm hoping that the film subverts your expectations of who or what. You know, what someone looks like that gets into trouble. And so in terms of transformation, you know, I feel like we were obsessed with this, you know, well, this person was a bad person and now they're good, or they were good and then they went bad. The film sort of pushes you as a human to really explore the depths of humanity and the complexity that is, you know, us as human beings, and how, you know, things are not as black or white as good and bad. You know, it's the gray area. And so the film shows that in terms of maturity and growing up and kindness and compassion, you know, there's definitely transformation in those areas. But The individual who I was, the kid that I was, you know, in elementary school and middle school, was the same kid that robbed the bank, and the same kid that went to prison, and the same person that, you know, made the film, you know, 17 years later. And that, you know, we have the capability to be more than one person. It's not that I was in prison and was rehabilitated, because that's not what prison is for. It really has no interest, you know, no one has really any interest in truly rehabilitating anyone. It's a miracle that can occur. But, you know, it's, you know, the film shows that my family went through a transformation, that we're in a better place now, that I had to go through an emotional transformation.
Yeah, and a lot of us who have experienced the criminal justice experience, and those of us who have spent time in prison know that our families, they do time as well.
Oh yeah,
and you know, it's just a reality that, you know, the families are doing time as well as the person who's doing the physical time. And what was your particular goal of telling your particular story? What was the goal behind that?
Yeah, I mean, the goal was to, you know, just show a different side of what's being presented across the media. You know, it's we have been inundated with images about black men being these angry, thug, savage animals by the media, liberal and conservative media, for all of our life. For decades, for as long as the media has been in existence, we have been presented with these very, very negative portrayals of black men. And even though I knew I had messed up and I made a mistake and I went to prison, I wanted to show that, you know what, a lot of times when watching the news, you see these men in handcuffs, that we have no context. The news is not giving us any context. The news is not giving us any real information. It's all surface. And instead of providing an audience with a barrage of statistics and pie charts and professionals,
sure,
I wanted to make a film about real people and how this prison industrial complex, how mass incarceration, how poverty, this endless cycle impacts real people. And I wanted to interview folks who were directly impacted by my life and these choices, and not just have people up there talking about just random numbers, because I feel like those numbers provide some form of safety and comfort for the masses. And I wanted them to see what real people go through and what real pain looks like, what real trauma looks like.
Right. So, once again, how can folks view the film?
Yeah, so Evolution of Criminal is available on iTunes. Currently, you can buy the film, you can download the film, rent the film on iTunes. It's also available for educational purposes at, you know, middle schools, high schools, and universities via Good Docs on that website. And then we have the evolutionofacriminal.com page and our Facebook page. And we'll be streaming on Netflix starting March 20th.
So other than monetary support, how can our listening audience support you?
I mean, just get the word out. You know, so in addition to, you know, the traditional screening venues, you know, I've been going to different juvenile detention centers, prisons, and I'm currently working on a full curriculum to accompany the film. And so I'm hoping people get the word out. I'm hoping people also look up the Ban the Box initiative that's happening right now in the state of New York about, you know, asking on college applications if you have a criminal background,
exactly,
getting rid of that box and allowing people to, again, start their lives over, or, you know, and grow and learn and not be stigmatized for prior events. And so, you know, folks look that up and support that. That'll be great as well.
Yes, most definitely. Folks don't realize that that Ban the Box is definitely an important thing that should be supported, because that small little box, brother, can make the difference in someone becoming gainfully employed, and giving back to society. That box definitely has to be abolished, and we need to not judge folks by things that they've done in the past. Now, what it's part of our mantra here that, You know, here in the state of New York, when someone goes before the parole board, if a person is denied parole, the boilerplate excuse for and the reason for denying someone parole is the nature of the crime. But here at On the Count, we understand that the nature of the crime will never change. But the potential of the character and the potential of the person has the, you know, all, nothing but change can come from the potential of people if given the opportunity. And that's what we ask, is just that we're given the opportunity, because there are some great things and great people that have passed through those bars and through those gates and looked out those cells. So we want to thank you, Darius.
That was WBAI's On the Count. You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. Thanks for tuning in today. If you want to reach out to us, please contact us at prisonvoicesproject@gmail.com. That's prisonvoicesproject@gmail.com. I volunteer for WGXC because I'm committed to building quality radio in the community I love. I got involved with the station because it allows a platform for sharing ideas and insights about the prison system to people who are behind bars and those who may never get access to those ideas. To make a contribution to WGXC, call 518-697-7400 or online at wgxc.org/donate. Your tax-deductible contribution will help sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement. Thank you for supporting local media in New York's Greene and Columbia counties. You can make a contribution by calling 518-697-7400 or online at wgxc.org/donate.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart.